Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with a young Libyan just back from Benghazi, where he witnessed the brutality of Gaddafi's regime mowing down freedom fighters with anti-aircraft cannons. Akram Ramadan joins us from London. Then we'll examine the role of the media and social media in the revolution sweeping the Middle East, with a particular focus on Al Jazeera. Marwan Krady, an expert on Arab media and politics, offers his analysis. Then finally, we'll look into the increasingly prominent role of dirty tricks in politics today. First, the sting by a Republican operative against NPR, and before that, a prank phone call that embarrassed the Republican governor of Wisconsin. Mark Feldstein, who teaches media and public affairs at George Washington University, joins us to look back at the role of dirty tricksters, as well as assessing their growing impact on politics today. And a quick reminder that this and early programs are available at ianmasters.com. I also write a daily essay, which you can get by clicking on the blog tab at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. Now let's go to an interview I did 2 hours ago with a young Libyan who, although I had to ask him the same question 3 times, is a part of the generation freeing themselves and putting their lives on the line in Libya. I'm speaking with Akram Ramadan, who is a London-based Libyan exile who just returned yesterday from Benghazi, where he witnessed freedom fighters liberating themselves and their families from the Gaddafi dictatorship. Welcome to Background Briefing, Akram Ramadan.
Welcome.
At this point, there is a call, I believe, for a no-fly zone over Libya, and over, in particular over Tripoli. What's your understanding of where things stand? Because it appears to be breaking down into a civil war. Is that the way you read the current situation?
Yeah, the current climate, that's what it suggests, to be honest. What I've seen there is just like the people are getting massacred, if you want to put a nicer term to it, for just the oil of the wealth of that country, to be honest, and this dictatorship to want to stay in power.
And what motivates Gaddafi's supporters? Because is it purely money?
No. Purely to be free, to be honest, to be just democratic. What started this problem was people asking for freedom of speech, and he went and hired some mercs and started sniping them out and shooting them out with 14.5-millimeter cannons, which started in Al Bayda. And the rebels, as they've been called all over the world, what I call them, freedom fighters, took over the prison in Al Bayda, then it escalated to another prison in Benghazi, and took a lot of weapons, and we are living it now. It's nearly 80-20 days, I think.
Akram, my question was, I understand that the freedom fighters, and you said you've witnessed bodies of those who attacked the arms depots in Benghazi, who were mowed down by anti-aircraft weapons, which indicate the brutality of the Gaddafi regime.
Yes, of course. It's a brutal regime. The people have been crying for nearly 40 years. And nobody's listening. You know, there have been demonstrations. They tried to, overturn the system, but foreign governments have intervened. It's been a massacre since Gaddafi took over, to be honest. He killed the education and he killed the health system. Basically, that's what the country is, to be honest, run by Gaddafi's and Gaddafi's goons.
So tell me, though, what do you think, Akram Ramadan, motivates the people who are fighting for Gaddafi? Are they purely doing it for money?
No, nobody's doing it for money. Okay, you might find it in any war like this, but what motivates them is to have a democratic system. When they open their minds and they speak loud, you know, and they start thinking loud, like most European countries, or all the European countries and most of the world, you know, just basic rights. But what really, really made them go with their lives is when they've seen people have been killed by mercenaries, basically. That's when Libyan armies handed down, when, you know, all the consulates and the embassies backed out and said, we resign from this regime. This motivates them. When you get a foreign body, it comes and starts kidnapping women. That what made me go there. When they started kidnapping women, raping them and burning them, and you don't see their bodies anymore. You go there, you hear stories, it's unbelievable. But when you see pictures and things that have been photographed and kept for evidence, it's indescribable, to be honest. I mean, the Libyans themselves think Israel is a terrorist state. And now they're saying, funny enough, I mean, it's not really funny, the matter said even Israel didn't do this stuff. Israel themselves, they cannot think of stuff that Gaddafi has come up with. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, I don't mean anything bad to the state of Israel, to be honest, but this is what the Libyans are saying inside. They say, bloody hell, even Israel didn't do this. So it's 6,000 guaranteed. I guarantee you 6,000 people have, you know, have died in these 18 days. And it's a very, very high death rate, to be honest. If it happened in Bosnia, if it happened in Kosovo, if it happened God knows where, it would be called an ethnic cleansing or something like that. But I don't know what to say, to be honest. It's heartbreaking, it's heart-wrenching, and it's a tear to your eye.
But Akram Ramadan, given that it looks like a kind of military stalemate where Gaddafi's forces are counterattacking, even though freedom fighters are close to Tripoli, what do you think keeps Gaddafi's fighters going? Is it purely money?
No, it's nothing to do with Gaddafi fighters.
Yes, the Gaddafi fighters.
You mean the guys, the pro-Gaddafis, you mean, that's what we're talking about now.
Yes, that's what I wanted to get. I wanted you to get your opinion of what
about
motivates
that.
Them.
Well, there's a 50% rumor, 50% truth, that every family from his big tribe, for example, Sirte, and some other towns, he's taking people out of houses. So if you're an officer in the Libyan army, they're going to take your brother out from that house and they put a gun to his head by one of the mercenaries, basically. The people who obey Gaddafi. Libyans don't obey Gaddafi. Libyans fear Gaddafi.
And
that's what makes them fight. That's one factor. The other factor, he's got all his brand new equipment there. Khamis, his son, Khamis, has got weapons never been seen before on the Middle East. Why he hasn't got media there? Why does he not let you guys go in? Why does he scramble most of the Arabic channels over Tripoli?
Well, what do you think, Akram Ramadan, is required now? If the
drastic situation needs a drastic answer. I leave that to your imagination, to be honest.
Right. Well, let's deal with one of the things on the table then, the no-fly zone. What's your opinion about that?
No-fly zone never works. It never worked in the last 10 years, well, in the 90s, mid-90s, when they had an embargo on him after Lockerbie and the UTA. It never worked. It just made other countries richer. For example, Tunisia and Malta, because we could not fly out. I was lucky enough to flee one of the last flights when that no-fly zone happened. And what did that do? Everything started coming through ships. Are you going to see all the harbors? Are you going to see all the harbors in Tunisia and Malta?
So what's it going to take to get rid of this monster and his family?
One guy said to me, Tom Cruise with Mission Impossible, to be honest.
So you think there should be a kind of covert action?
A drastic action, whichever way you want.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you're going in my way, I think I'll probably put a cruise as soon as he puts his bloody phone on.
But tell me though, Akram Ramadan, would there be a backlash if Europeans went in there and took out Gaddafi?
Well, Europeans can. I'll tell you, some people don't mind actually. I mean, people, taxi drivers in particular, turn into politicians all of a sudden. And I picked up a lot of chit chat and people what they want and what their aspirations are and what they're trying to see, and a sweet collection of ideas. But they want him out. I mean, if America comes and have a base like it had before when the king was there, they don't mind. But what the problem is with them, they don't want to start fighting the Americans or fighting the Europeans. The Americans and the Europeans, they should contact the right people. Now, I mean, Mr. Haig, the foreign minister for the United Kingdom government, I think they didn't ask the right guys. I mean, they've got files on us. People have been campaigning in the UK for the last 14 years, 10 years. I mean, I started campaigning against Gaddafi, or as they say it, victory day for me was 2004, because we lost fear of Gaddafi. We used to fear him a lot. It was 2004 for me, and most Libyans haven't got that fear anymore. So that's one of the first victories in a situation like this. To get rid of him, they need guidance and speak to the right people. There's a lot of opposition people who live in the States who can give them a good idea. But I wouldn't be talking to a scholar like your researcher talked to me before. I think your producer spoke to me before. The guy has been in that country, in America, for example, for the last, I don't know, 30 years. He never even Googled Libya until this happened, until one of the places where probably his villages or his family is. Got blown up or got beaten or heard something nasty. So they really should look into the foreign bodies or the Libyan in exile who have been campaigning for the last, I don't know, for the last 20 years about Gaddafi. People got shot in front of the Libyan embassy with Yvonne Fletcher. They're still campaigning till today. One of them used to be the head of Newsweek Arabic, Mr. Mahmoud Shammah. He's one of the Libyan opposition leaders. Mr. Briggs, where's he? Newsweek now. He's a Libyan, and so I think the American government should be looking at the right places at the right time. Go and jump in a helicopter and go landing in El Kish or whatever it's called. Man, the guys there's like the cowboys, just like the people of Texas. They haven't seen a foreign guy for a long time coming out of a helicopter with machine guns in his hand. I think it's the wrong way to go. There's so many cards have to be played, and have to be played right, to be honest.
So, Akram Ramadan, your family's had a long history of oppression from the Gaddafis, right? Your father was a political prisoner.
Yes, he was a PhD. He was a professor in a Tripoli University, which he changed his name to Al Fatah University. No, no. He was a professor there, and he was just started working on the solar power program and the nuclear power program. And when he's been ordered to change direction and go into, you know, something else. And the rest is history. I mean, they took him in. On 7th of the 5th, 1984, there was the beginnings of a coup in Libya, in Bab al-Azizia. And that night, he got arrested. You know, all the scholars have been arrested, American graduates, UK graduates, PhD holders, master's holders, stuff like this. A lot of people went to that hellhole called Abu Slim prison, which had the massacre after that in 1996. Luckily, my dad got released in 88, and then he claimed asylum back in the UK. I was born where he was doing his PhDs here in the UK, so I think that's one of the luckiest things happened to Libya, that I am outside this country, I can speak with.
Sure. And that massacre in 1996 that you referred to, at the
1,270 people.
Right.
But documented. We've got them all documented, picture by picture, photo by photo.
And what's worth noting here is that massacre was conducted by Gaddafi's brother-in-law,
Abdullah Snoussi,
right, who was recently entertained by Beyonce.
No, the one who's been entertained by Beyonce is Saif al-Islam and the other idiot.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, Abdullah Snoussi goes out of Libya, he will probably get assassinated he's unwanted on all the wanted lists by probably all the other terrorist groups who've been bouncing about in Europe at that time.
I see. So what do you think is going to happen to this family? Are they going to...
The Gaddafis?
Yeah, they're going to sneak away and spend all their stolen billions, or are they going to be...
Oh, no, you have to change that number. It's not a billion or billions. You have to go a bit more than that. It starts with the letter T. It's trillions.
Are you serious?
I am not joking you.
Wow. So tell me, what do you think is going to happen to them? They're going to end up against the wall like Ceausescu, or are they going to find some safe haven?
I think I've got a different view. I call it Ella Hitler.
Uh-huh. Oh, you think he's going to take a pill?
You know how Hitler died?
Yeah.
That's it.
I see.
That's how I call him, Ella Hitler.
And so when do you think this is going to happen?
It depends what pressure is on him. Depends how much pressure is on him. I mean, if the freedom fighters, the FFs are knocking on his door, he'll probably do it because he's going to run out of people protecting him.
Well, that won't be a day too soon. And in the meantime, thousands of your countrymen are dying. Is there any kind of final appeal that you want to make, or any ideas?
I have an idea. I might even page you up today on Facebook if Facebook doesn't kick me out, to be honest. I'm asking for all the Libyan students abroad who are on grants from the Libyan government and that who have been stopped yesterday from receiving any money anymore from the embassies, because the embassies do not exist anymore. Most foreign governments do not declare government as a state yet, but they don't say it loudly. But now embassies are working abroad. I witnessed when the London embassy fell. So I asked these guys, go and claim asylum and put pressure on your countries. I'm so sorry to say this, but I think that's not a card we have to play on top of them. Libya has got 5,000 students just in the UK. Funny enough, there's 200 in Sandhurst Academy becoming future officers. God knows what happens, because Gaddafi came from Sandhurst. He stayed 1.5 years in it, and then he became the coup leader, founder of this Al-Jamahiriyyah.
It's amazing to me that this man has been treated as a world statesman, if you will, or at least a legitimate
leader. He's been treated like the king of Africa, the statesman. He's been invited to the States. He's been invited to London. Well, in London, we stopped into it. We went to the prime minister and said, hey, he comes to London and somebody's going to kill him. Don't even think of doing something like this. So that's why he's never been accepted here. And then that's why he had so much bodyguards with him in France, because France allowed them, because he can pay them off, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
It's weird, the world, how it runs.
Well, look, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles. Akram Ramadan.
We're in Los Angeles. Thank you very much, Los Angeles. Thank you for listening to us, and thank you for all your interest. Thank you.
Thank you. I was speaking then with Akram Ramadan, a London-based Libyan exile who just returned yesterday from Benghazi, where he witnessed freedom fighters liberating themselves and their families from the Gaddafi dictatorship. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Al Jazeera's double standard. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm now joined by Marwan Krady, who is a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He is an expert on Arab media and politics and was the founding director of the Arab Media and Public Life Project at American University. His books include Hybridity, or The Cultural Logic of Globalization, Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life, and Arab Television Industries. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marwan Krady.
Thank you.
Yesterday, I spoke with a journalist with the only independent newspaper in Bahrain, and obviously Bahrain has receded from the headlines because so much of the world's press attention has been diverted to Libya. But I understand that Al Jazeera, which has played a very strong and positive role in these series of revolutions in the Middle East, has something of a double standard. It has very critical reportage of Mubarak in Egypt and of Gaddafi in Libya, but it essentially backpedals on Bahrain, which is close to home.
Absolutely. If you follow the coverage, one of the things you'll notice is that it started with Tunisia, with what was going on there. The coverage was very active, very committed to the side of the demonstrators, in the sense that there was a general feeling that the demonstrators were on the right side of history, and this is how Al Jazeera was going to cover it. In Egypt, it emerged even more of a player in terms of how it covered the demonstration. It was a bit lukewarm at the beginning, and then within a couple of days, it was again, it went fully into Tahrir Square and other parts of Egypt. And then once the demonstrations in Bahrain came, something very strange happened, which it looked as if Al Jazeera was not as much covering the protest negatively, but it was very ambivalent. For instance, it would show speakers in the name of the Bahraini royal family speaking about vandalism, the demonstrators as vandals, the demonstrators as people who are creating chaos, and chaos is not welcomed. They are subverting social order, without giving a chance for any rebuttal of that point of view. While in Egypt, it would have footage of the demonstrators in Tahrir Square, and then it would have a series of Egyptian commentators, poets, intellectuals, professors, writers, politicians, lawyers, commenting very enthusiastically and in many cases very passionately about the uprising. We didn't see anything of that sort with Bahrain.
And this, of course, Marwan Krady, is Al Jazeera Arabic we're talking about. What's the difference between Al Jazeera Arabic's reporting and Al Jazeera English?
Al Jazeera English has been more consistent in its coverage. It's been more even between Tunisia, Bahrain, Egypt, Libya. Although, I mean, the Libya story now is obviously the dominant story, as it is in Western media outlets and Arab media outlets, and with Al Jazeera English. But overall, Al Jazeera English has been more consistent.
And what is the relationship of the ruling family in Qatar, the Al Thanis, with Al Jazeera? I mean, in terms of, let's use the comparison of Rupert Murdoch to Fox.
Yes, it is not. The relationship between the Al Thani family and Al Jazeera, I would say, is less direct than the relationship between Rupert Murdoch and Fox. The royal family of the ruling family of Qatar did bankroll Al Jazeera when it started. What happened is Al Jazeera was really part of an effort to revamp Qatar's politics, both internally and in terms of its foreign policy. And what Qatar did is it got rid of the information ministry, which a lot of people in the West hailed as a step towards press freedom. And then it launched Al Jazeera, which reported to the foreign ministry in Qatar. And so it's very clear that Al Jazeera is part of Qatar's foreign policy. It's not the kind of propaganda instrument that some people argue it is. It doesn't get direct orders. But I think the broad parameters of its coverage do take into account the agenda and the sensibilities of the Qatari ruling family. One example, one of the things you'll notice is that when Bahrain started, the rulers of the Gulf Cooperation Council countries, which include Qatar, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia, they met, and there was a decision that we're not going to let this happen here. And as soon as that started, you could tell that Al Jazeera's coverage of Bahrain was muted. Even the last few days, I've also noticed that Al Jazeera's coverage of Saudi Arabia has become even more muted. So Al Jazeera was famous when it started in 1996, and then in the ensuing years of being very critical of the Saudi royal family, for example. And over the years, that has changed. So there was a reconciliation of sort between the Al Saud and Al Thani. You could tell that the coverage changed a little bit. And in the last few days, there is something going on in terms of watching Al Jazeera makes me feel that there's an agreement among the rulers of the Gulf monarchies that we're not going to let the demonstrations that happened elsewhere happen here. And one of the ways in which we're not going to let them grow is we're not going to give coverage to what already exists. Yemen is kind of an interesting story because Yemen is also a neighbor of Saudi Arabia. It's close geographically to Bahrain and Qatar as well. Relatively speaking, evidently, in relative to Libya, for instance. And Yemen is covered a little more than Bahrain, but much less than Libya on Al Jazeera. So as if there's a spectrum of kinds of depth and breadth of coverage that seem to be aligned with the foreign policies of Qatar and its decision to be in solidarity with other Gulf countries.
Again, I'm speaking with Professor Marwan Krady, who is an expert on Arab media and politics. And is the sort of double standard between being critical of military dictatorships and soft-pedaling monarchies? Let's focus on Jordan. How is Al Jazeera covering the uprisings in Jordan, given that that is a monarchy?
It is not. Jordan has been an interesting story in the sense that its coverage of Jordan has been muted all across the media spectrum in the Arab world and globally. Maybe because in Jordan, the famous memo that the king sent instructions about reform and all that were very early. We were still at the beginning of the Egypt uprising when there was a sense in Jordanian political circle that something needs to happen. Coverage of Jordan has been minimal. It's probably relative to what is going on the ground in Jordan, which is, again, relative to Libya, relative to Bahrain, relative to Yemen, not much. So I haven't seen as much coverage of Jordan as I've seen of Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. But I would say it's probably a little more than what Bahrain is getting, but not by much.
Well, what struck me yesterday, Marwan Krady, with the interview I did with the reporter with the only independent newspaper in Bahrain, was that there was a certain nervousness and self-censorship going on within the interview. For example, she would never refer to Saudi Arabia by name, just as a powerful neighbor, and was very careful not to criticize the king, but say that there were those that were trying to drive a wedge between the Sunni minority and the Shia majority and spreading hate through the media, the local media. But at the end of it all, what she called for and what she expected was some kind of constitutional monarchy. Mm-hmm. It seems that in the Gulf, and I imagine it's true in Saudi Arabia, the sights are not set that high for change as they are in other parts like Egypt and mm-hmm. of course, Libya. Would you agree with that?
Well, a couple of things. So a lot of the demonstrators had been asking for a constitutional monarchy. I mean, don't forget, Bahrain is a very, very peculiar context in the sense that it's a very small country. It's been a playground for kind of proxy Cold War, so to speak, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, partly because of the sectarian composition, partly because Bahrain is politically to some extent, but socially a lot more liberal than its neighbors. So it has quite a peculiar status in the region. But there's one very interesting development that happened yesterday, two actually, in Bahrain. One of them was that until yesterday, we've seen a lot of calls for a constitutional monarchy. Yesterday, there were actually calls to turn Bahrain into a republic for the first time in the protests. That's one. Two, there were some very deliberate calls from leaders in the protest for sectarian harmony, for not letting... there's a perception among some of the demonstrators, at least, that the government might use sectarian tensions between the Shia majority and the ruling Sunni minority to stoke these tensions among the protesters and divide them with, you know, using that as a wedge. So I'm not so sure that the expectations are lower. We have seen calls for a republic in Bahrain for the first time after weeks of demands for a constitutional monarchy. So things might be changing.
Now, is this being reported on Al Jazeera Arabic, that what you just said about the calls for a republic?
I haven't watched it. I haven't seen it, but I haven't been watching it 24 hours, so I don't know, but I have not seen it.
In your work that you do, Professor Marwan Crady, who's an expert on Arab media and politics and professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, in terms of this feeling that these regime changes and revolutions in the Middle East are being driven by social media and how the prominent role that Al Jazeera has played, it sort of leads to a very paradoxical question. On the one hand, Google and its executive in Egypt was a hero. So it seems like America, in terms of Silicon Valley, is making a positive contribution. But in terms of all the money that we've spent on trying to set up broadcast American sort of Voice of America type broadcasts in the Middle East, that looks like it's gone nowhere. Give us an update on how Al Arabiya and all these other outlets are doing compared to Al Jazeera.
Well, you know, today there are, depending on who you ask, anywhere between 500 and 750 satellite channels broadcasting transnationally, in other words, with areas of coverage anywhere between Morocco and Iraq, two dozen countries, in Arabic by satellite. Now, among these, in times of conflict, Al Jazeera does remain the dominant channel, even in the countries where there are strong alternatives. Al Arabiya is number two, although my sense is, depending how things go, their coverage of the protests, at least the early coverage, was extremely cautious. They lost, my sense is that they did lose viewers, even more viewers, to Al Jazeera. There are other channels that compete for Arabs' attentions, but they don't tend to be as successful as the two big ones, Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. Al Hurra, from what I understand, is really has a very, very, very minimal following.
And which one is that now?
Al Hurra is the U.S. channel.
Oh,
don't
the U.S.
forget. So we're not talking only about the indigenous channels, which number in the hundreds. You have Al Alam, which is sponsored by the Iranian government. You have Russia Al Yaoum, an Arabic channel sponsored by the Russian government. You have a French channel, a German channel, BBC Arabic. The Chinese have a channel, and the Turks have a channel, TRT7 Al Turkiya. And some of these seem to be at least as popular, if not more, than the American channel Al Hurra. So I do think Al Hurra is not a very good investment for American taxpayers.
And who's behind Al Arabiya then?
Al Arabiya was launched by, it's definitely the main capital behind it was Saudi. It is very close to the Saudi royal family. There was some Lebanese and some Kuwaiti investors at the beginning, but it's definitely reflective of Saudi politics and Saudi foreign policy.
I spoke recently, Marwan Crady, with a Saudi human rights activist in Washington, D.C., and I was stunned by what he said, and I have no way to know whether it's accurate or not, that within Saudi, the young people are probably more social media savvy than they are in Egypt because there's much greater internet penetration, and that they're just as frustrated with the notion that the ruling family, just like the Mubarak ruling family, are sitting on their future. And while they're not necessarily going to go after the king, their hatred is directed at those under the king, and that the notion that we always hear, as we did in Egypt, that, oh, the only alternative to Mubarak is the Muslim Brotherhood. What we're told about Saudi Arabia is that if the royals fall, then the bin Laden Wahhabis are going to take over. This dissident human rights activist said, no way. He said that the Saudi people, the young ones in particular, are fed up with religion and the religious police. Mm-hmm. What's your understanding?
There's definitely evidence that, for instance, there have been surveys that I've used in my own research about Saudis as a people being less religious than, say, Egyptians. Right, so we tend to think Saudi Arabia tends to be portrayed in the Western media as this nation of people for whom Islam is the beginning and the end of their life, that dictates everything, that rules everything. That is perhaps the official line that the Quran is the country's constitution, that Sunni Islam is the official religion and all that. And I'm not saying that Saudis are not pious, but there are lots of other issues in their lives. Other than religion, that motivate what they do and how they think. And definitely politics, a sense of justice, issues like the rule of law, issues of the rights of minorities. For instance, the Shia minority in Saudi Arabia is treated like a second-class citizen group. Those are all issues that are very important. So I think the claim that the only alternative to the royal family would be Al-Qaeda are exaggerated, although there's very little evidence from the ground to know who would be an alternative if something were to happen in Saudi Arabia. What we do know is that evidently the Saudi royal family has attempted several kind of preemptive moves. One of them was the distribution of a lot of resources when the Saudi king, King Abdullah, came back from overseas for medical treatment. He announced a lot of raises, social benefits, investments to the tune of more than $30 billion. So major amounts of money to kind of preempt any kind of social unrest. There have also been calls by religious leaders in Saudi Arabia against demonstrations, saying demonstrations are un-Islamic, demonstrations are not the Saudi way of doing things. So they're definitely nervous about what's going on. There have been calls on Facebook for demonstrations. They haven't led to anything major yet, except in the eastern province, which is predominantly Shia. There have been some protests. There have been some repression of the protests, but the Saudi government so far has not been playing the kind of very heavy hand that we see the Libyans, the Libyan regime, or what's left of it playing.
Well, apparently there is a protest scheduled for March the 11th. So, just in closing, do you think that the big shoe could drop? Let's face it, the U.S. has been caught by surprise, and I think in part because of our foreign policy focuses on Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's where all of our Arabic speakers are, all our intelligence assets are, and it looks like we've been completely caught by surprise by Tunisia and by Egypt and even Libya. Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to get caught by surprise in Saudi Arabia? And as we all know, Saudi Arabia is the 900-pound gorilla when it comes to world energy supplies.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't, you know, it's very, nobody could have predicted. It's not only the U.S. intelligence community or foreign policy. Those of us who had hoped for political change never expected it to happen so quickly, never expected to see this kind of domino effect from one country to the other. The problem is that you have some kind of contestation in most Arab countries going on right now. Iraq, for instance, there are lots of anti-government demonstrations in Iraq that are not very well covered in the Western media. We have Oman, right? Oman is also a neighbor in the Gulf. And it's not very well covered. Whether Saudi Arabia will fall or not, it's too early to predict, but I wouldn't say it's impossible. I mean, you know, Egypt looked impossible. Six months ago, nobody would have predicted that things would happen so quickly in Egypt. I hate to do a cheap cop-out, but I think anything is possible.
Well, I thank you for talking with us today, Marwan Khredi.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Marwin Crady, who is the professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where he researches Arab media and politics. His books include Reality Television and Arab Politics, Contention in Public Life and Arab Television Industries. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the growing role of dirty tricks in politics today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Mark Feldstein, who is the teaches media and public affairs at George Washington University and is the author of a new book, Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. For two decades, he was an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN and ABC and other news outlets. Thank you for joining us on Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Oh, always my pleasure, Ian.
And today has been a bad day for NPR. The chief fundraiser for NPR was caught in a sting by this fellow O'Keefe, who already stung the Acorn people before that, and was arrested posing as a cable repair guy in the offices of Senator Mary Landrieu down in Louisiana. And nevertheless, this apparently gullible chief of fundraising for NPR listened to this pitch, was talking, willfully negotiating with somebody claiming ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. At the same time, he trashed the Tea Party. And this has forced the resignation today of Vivian Schiller, who is no relation to the other Schiller who resigned. She resigned today, the CEO of NPR. And of course, this will be grist for the mill in terms of the Republicans in the House who want to zero out funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So I suppose, Mark, we cannot underestimate the influence of these little political dirty tricks. They really have big consequences.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, political dirty tricks are as American as apple pie, and they go back all the way to the founding fathers. But what we have now, besides increased partisanship, is technological sophistication with hidden cameras that allow it to be done much more easily. I mean, this one can be interpreted through a political lens as yet another sort of right-wing attack going after liberals. But, you know, fundraisers, I suspect that if he had said outrageous, right-wing things, the fundraiser might have agreed, too, because that's what fundraisers do. They try to get along with people with big bucks who were promising to donate money.
Well, but I think he had to be a bit gullible because I'm surprised he didn't recognize this guy, O'Keefe. And I'm also surprised that he took a check that for a ton of money, I think millions of dollars, that was written on a P.O. box at a UPS drop, and that the foundation that supposedly supports the Muslim Brotherhood had no 501c3, no tax ID number. So, I suppose people who get stung, buyer beware, I suppose. But of course,
well, yeah, and there's that old saying, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Well, I must say, though, on the other side of the political fence, where instead of this being a Republican hit against one of their favorite targets, in this case NPR, and prior to that Acorn, the recent prank phone call that the gullible governor of Wisconsin fell forth and had a 20-minute conversation with an imposter posing as one of his biggest fundraisers or biggest donors, David Koch, that really got into the political zeitgeist. And my feeling is that when these things get into the political zeitgeist and get on YouTube, it's probably, in political terms, worth about 1,000 appearances on Meet the Press.
Well, I think that's right, because what you're doing is you're getting a glimpse of the way things really work as opposed to the canned responses on a show like Meet the Press. And in a sense, both of these stings, as contrived as they were, do peel back the layers of how things are done officially, whether it's sucking up and fundraising to and lack of vetting in a desperate desire for bucks by a place like NPR, or a politician who publicly is putting out this persona of just focusing on doing his job, and then privately strategizing with this right-wing oil billionaire about how to screw the unions and screw the Democrats, and it peels the veneer off, the mask off of the more sanctimonious facades that are usually presented to the public.
Well, one of the people, of course, who's come out today feeling vindicated is Juan Williams, who was fired by NPR, not by Vivian Schiller, but by somebody else who also was fired, in response to the Republican outrage over Juan Williams' firing. He, of course, is saying, oh, this is just shows you that NPR are just a bunch of white people and who look down on blacks and ordinary people. Of course, you could argue that Juan Williams' role at Fox News is exactly fits that description. Isn't he surrounded by white people on Fox?
Well, it's a predominantly a white audience as well as on-air crowd, although that's true. It's not like the other networks are exactly, the proportions may be greater, but, management particularly is white at almost all these places.
But what does it say to you about, Mark Feldstein, who teaches media and public affairs at George Washington University, formerly with CNN and ABC, what does this say to you about NPR in a way that they very quickly fired Juan Williams, very quickly fired the woman who fired Juan Williams because it was an outcry, and now fired Ron Schiller, who got punked or pranked by this O'Keefe Republican operator. And he also said, by the way, in this video, Ron Schiller, it's very clear that in the long run, we would be better off without federal funding. This is at a time when NPR is trying to make a case not to have their money cut. So my sense is that there's something sort of, inherently wrong with the culture at NPR, where because they are at the mercy of government funding and at the whims of Republicans who are routinely calling for their extinction, that they try so desperately not to have opinions that, they've got to the point where they can't even be real human beings and have points of view.
Well, obviously there's a lot of fear over at NPR about the Republicans in the House, Republicans taking over the House and wanting to cut the funding for NPR. And, this is always the dilemma that public broadcasting faces. And it's true in the U.S. It's, true in other countries as well. But the U.S., our culture, our DNA is much more, is much less sympathetic to the notion of public broadcasting, of government funding or taxpayer funding for kind of quality broadcasting. And so they get much less than say, the BBC does. But obviously they're running scared. And, a lot of these bloodlettings, like took place at NPR, occur at the for-profit networks, too, whenever there's a scandal. Heads roll and as the system tries to disassociate itself from the scandal. I don't think there's any evidence that Vivian Schiller, who resigned today, the head of NPR, really had any culpability involved in the fundraiser saying those things. But it was just because she'd come under assault for, several other things, mostly on the Juan Williams case. It was kind of the final straw that broke the camel's back.
Well, but the serial firing, I think, it indicates a kind of lack of moral fiber as opposed to, having principles and standing by the fact that, we're we're not perfect, and we make mistakes. How many times have you seen these mea culpas from politicians who get caught? What about the guy down in Florida? I was going to say the governor of Florida being a mega crook, but the senator down in Louisiana, they got caught with a hooker.
Well, politicians are very different from media organizations in that culture. I mean,
right. I see
I
what
think
you're
if
saying.
You ask Dan Rather how CBS handled the National Guard story, where he ended up losing his job over it, as did a number of other people, he would say that NPR doesn't have any monopoly on that kind of institutional reaction. Now, I'm not sure, which is not to equate the retracted story that CBS did with, the problems at NPR, but I do think institutional cultures of all kind, private and public, tend to operate in some similar ways, and that is to kind of isolate the person who's giving them the black eye, blame it on them and disassociate it from them if the cost is too high. I mean, it's a long way from Ben Bradley at the Washington Post when it was under fire for an actual mistake that Woodward and Bernstein made on their coverage, just hanging tough and saying, we stand by our story, we stand by our people. You don't see that very often in corporate media or in, as it turns out now, in NPR, in the public broadcasting.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Feldstein, who's the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. For two decades, he was an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and other news outlets, and he now teaches media and public affairs at George Washington University. But, Mark, you've brought up something which I'd really like to explore here in the Dan Rather case. There is a coincidence here. Dan Rather was a huge target for Brent Bozell and those right-wing Republican media watchdog groups, and they were after him for the longest time. And he claims that the stuff that he got was deliberately doctored. And then the other case is that the person that got fired was the head of CNN, Eason Jordan, who was again a target for Brent Bozell and these right-wing Republican media watchdog groups.
There's no question that the right wing has, in this country, going back to Nixon and before, developed a dirty tricks operation over the years. In fact, Dan Rather himself was a target of Richard Nixon personally. I write about these issues in my book. Nixon himself, the President of the United States, in the Oval Office, we know from the tape recordings, was ordering up dirty tricks against Rather, planting letters to try to get him fired, and Nixon aides were trying to get him fired, that kind of thing. So you're absolutely right. He's been a bête noire of the right for some time. And CBS ultimately... got rid of him, many years later after he crossed the Bush administration. So the right does seem to be more sophisticated at this than the left has been, notwithstanding, Governor Walker's, the prank call to Governor Walker.
But it's difficult in this current situation not to see a link between the sting by O'Keefe, who is a Republican operative. There's no question about it, whether he's an official member of any Republican group or not. And I'd be very interested to know who actually funds him. The timing of this sting coinciding with the House and Senate vote on zeroing out CPB is too coincidental. The knocking off Acorn, which was a very effective voter registration group, which literally mostly added to the Democratic ranks, which the Republicans didn't like. This guy is serving the Republican Party, the interests of the Republican Party, surely.
No question, and the old Watergate refrain, follow the money. It would be very interesting to know how all of this is being funded. There's an element of sophistication in the targets that are being picked, and they have definitely been hitting the solar plexus of the liberal left.
And
we saw this with Clinton too when Clinton was president, and you know, these right wing groups, Richard Mellon Scaife, raised all, you know, was donating millions of dollars for the so-called Arkansas Project, that, you know, the sole aim of which was to discredit the Clintons. And, you know, eventually they succeeded, not with any corruption or policy issues, but with the sex scandal that led to his impeachment.
But I find it extraordinary that the people like O'Keefe, who was actually fined for breaking into Senator Landrieu's office, he's a hero. David Bossie, the guy that made the hit job film on Hillary the movie, that became the basis of the Supreme Court Citizens United decision. Prior to that, he worked for Dan Burton's committee, and he edited the prison tapes of Webb Hubble to incriminate Webb Hubble, and had to be fired for blatant distortion and the same kind of hit job that Andrew Breitbart did on that woman who was fired from the Agriculture Department. Again, very preemptively, when the Republicans attack somebody, the first instinct is to fire them, you know?
And it goes back even farther than that. You know, Bossie was working with a group that that was involved in, you know, again, in the Clinton stuff and some of the sex stuff. And even before that, the Willie Horton ad that ran against Dukakis and you know, was considered pretty pivotal in the first George Bush winning election as president. So there is definitely in the DNA there a dirty trick gene, and the dirty tricks of Richard Nixon and his acolytes, who are still players, you know, in contemporary times, live on.
And we've got through this whole interview without mentioning Karl Rove.
Well, Karl Rove got his start with Richard Nixon.
And Lee Atwater,
Roger Ailes, who runs Fox News, got his start with Nixon. Cheney, Rumsfeld, you know, they all go back to that that administration that, you know, the only president had to resign in disgrace, and that's known for dirty tricks. Mm-hmm. So
it's a little
more subtly done now than it was done under Nixon, but who knows, if it weren't for the White House tapes, we may not know at all, you know, the details of what Nixon did.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mark Feldstein.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. I'm going to be in L.A. on Wednesday doing a book signing at Book Soup.
Well, come by and visit us. We'll make sure of that. Again, I was just talking with Mark Feldstein, who teaches media and public affairs at George Washington University, and is the author of a new book, Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. Let me thank, this has been Background Briefing, and I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I've also started a daily blog there. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog, and then let me know what you think. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.